from WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Federal Reserve came out with new numbers yesterday saying things seem to be looking up. Not a lot, but steady as she goes. On Wall Street, the Dow made record highs Tuesday and Wednesday. We've all been waiting a long time for the economy to take off again, and it's so tempting to say, well, this is it. But we've been burned before. This hour On Point, our roundtable of economics reporters sit down and try to make sense of the numbers. You can join the conversation. What does your 401k look like these days? Are you willing to bet on the stock market, or do you think that's still a fool's errand? Joining me now are three great economics reporters. All of them are in New York today, in one case because of the snowstorm here. Trish Regan is anchor on Bloomberg Television and host of Bloomberg's daily business program, Street Smart. Trish Regan, great to have you.
Oh, thank you very much, Jane. Great to be here.
Greg Zuckerman is a senior writer at the Wall Street Journal and author of the widely read Heard on the Street column. He's author of The Greatest Trade Ever and is currently working on a book on America's new energy boom and what that will mean for the global economy. Greg, thanks for taking the time with us.
Great to be here.
And Matt Phillips covers finance, markets, and economics for the new online business journal Quartz. His Twitter handle is at Matthew Phillips. Matt, great to have you, too. Thanks.
Great to be here, Jane.
So before we start, let's hear it. After breaking records set back in 2007, just before the Great Recession, on Tuesday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went even higher, edging up 42 points to 14,296 when the bells finally struck. So the stock market has recovered all of what was lost during the Great Recession. Dow is up nearly 9% already this year. What do you make of this record week, Trish Regan?
Well, Jane, it's incredible. The market's really been on a tear. And it calls into question just exactly what's going on in the economy right now, because I wouldn't say that the economic fundamentals are necessarily there to justify such a huge run-up. But investors are very encouraged by the aggressive policies of the Federal Reserve, and they're continuing to bid market prices up. Stock prices just keep moving higher, and for the foreseeable future, they may continue to do the same.
Mention those economic fundamentals. Greg Zuckerman, there are encouraging signs. Home prices jumped nearly 10% in January from a year ago, the biggest increase since 2006. U.S. companies are reporting record profits. Even the Fed has been sounding pretty optimistic with his comments about economic growth. What are the other hopeful signs to your mind?
Sure. Well, we're in a point where the economy, maybe outside the coasts, is really seeing some real resurgence and resilience. If you look at the manufacturing industry, the housing market, the energy revolution going on, you've got real pockets of strength. And it's important to remember that corporate America actually came into this downturn a little stronger than individuals and than the government, because the government piled up debt. So corporate America's balance sheets are pretty strong. They're not hiring as much as we'd like them to be. But the profits are there, and stock prices are not really expensive at this point, hence the excitement about the market.
So, Matt, pockets of strength, and yet unemployment is still high. Greg mentioned companies are slow to hire. The messages from Washington are certainly pretty grim now with the sequester. What's the disconnect here between financial markets and the economy?
Well, I think that financial markets are usually really forward-looking, so they're not really so concerned with the fact that many Americans' incomes still continue to be lagging where they were before we went into the financial crisis. They're looking forward, and you can see that in some of the stocks that have done so well have been very related to housing. I mean, if you look at the home building stocks, I mean, they're nowhere near where they were at their peaks in like 2005, but they've really surged. They've almost doubled, I think, over the last couple of years, and that reflects optimism. It doesn't necessarily reflect fact.
And so why do things look so rosy on Wall Street when it feels still pretty bleak for so many Americans who are struggling to regain their footing, Trish?
Well, there's an old expression, Jane, don't fight the Fed. And investors certainly don't want to take the chance of fighting the Fed. The Fed has pumped so much liquidity into the system. I mean, think about the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve and how much it has grown since 2007. It's really quite extraordinary what the Fed has done, the aggressive tactics they have taken. So as a result, investors are saying, okay, we don't want to bet against the Fed. We've got this zero interest rate policy that's going to continue for the foreseeable future, perhaps even as long as 2016, is something that Ben Bernanke mentioned the other day when he said he didn't think the unemployment rate would actually get to 6.5% before 2016. So they're saying, we're going to bet on the Fed, therefore we're going to raise up asset prices. And you brought it up. I think there's a disconnect between the fundamentals in this economy and what stock prices are doing. And that's something that can give you pause, because we're still looking at an unemployment rate that's 7.9%. You have 13 million people out of work compared with roughly 7 in 2007. So there are some things to be concerned about right now.
Let's talk about the Fed. Greg Zuckerman, Trish referred to the aggressive tactics of the Fed. Here's Greg Smith, one of our listeners online, saying, my question is this real or is the Fed propping us up? I hear lots of people saying it's time to get out. How do you respond to something like that?
Right. So that's what the skeptics say. I wrote a whole story about that today. They would argue that it's sort of like a ball player who is hitting home runs after home run, but is really being artificially juiced. And our economy is being juiced by the Fed in that interest rates are so low. The Federal Reserve has taken extraordinary measures to do things like buying back bonds, pushing down interest rates still further. And the skeptics, the bears, say, well, when interest rates finally get back to where they should be, when they're not being helped by the Fed, then the economy is going to get really crippled and the markets will be as well. I grant that, but I would argue that stocks are not very expensive here. The market has come back, but on an inflation-adjusted basis, we're not near the all-time highs. On all kinds of ratios, price to earnings, price to dividend yields, all kinds of cash flow measures, stocks aren't cheap, but they're not expensive. So I don't think you should be excessively bearish or worried here. I think that this reflects some real pockets of strength, again, manufacturing, housing, and the energy industry.
Matt Phillips, what do you think?
Well, one thing I'd point out about what the Federal Reserve is doing, and I think this is something of what you're seeing in the markets right now, is for a long time, the Federal Reserve had their foot slammed on the gas pedal, desperately trying to get something to happen in the economy. And not very much was happening because we suffered a financial crisis and people were deleveraging. They were trying to pay down debt. If you are trying to get rid of your debt, it doesn't matter that it becomes really cheap to borrow. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing demand for borrowing starting to pick up. And that's a sign that more of a normal situation is starting to occur in the economy. And you can see this in a couple different places where the Fed's programs are starting to bear some fruit. Auto sales have really been surging. They're above 15 million annualized a year. Those have been really huge. If you read the Fed's beige book, their anecdotal report on the economy that came out yesterday, they talk about auto dealerships across the country have really been going gangbusters. And housing, I mean, housing, it's nowhere back to where it has been, but it's important to keep in mind that just having it not detract from the rest of the economy would be a huge advantage going forward. So I think while everyone wants to criticize the Fed because it sort of like offends people's sensibilities that they meddle in the markets, I mean, that's what they always do. I think it's important to note that what they've done in terms of lowering interest rates, and specifically with their QE3 program that targets housing specifically through the mortgage market, that has been really generating some fruit, and I don't think they get enough credit for it.
Here's President Obama. He's speaking to reporters last Friday at the White House. He says that the sequestration cuts will bring major harm to the economy looking forward in the coming months. Here he is.
It will cost about 750,000 jobs at a time when we should be growing jobs more quickly. So every time that we get a piece of economic news over the next month, next 2 months, next 6 months, as long as the sequester is in place, we'll know that that economic news could have been better if Congress had not failed to act.
Ominous warnings, Trish Regan, from the president last Friday. Those cuts have yet to be felt, but is pain on the way? And will markets respond accordingly, Trish?
The markets aren't actually that worried, Jane, about the sequester. They were worried about the fiscal cliff, but we managed to make it through that okay. And now we're in the sequestration period, and it's $85 billion. And the reality is, as a percentage of what we're looking at for our overall deficit or our overall debt, for that matter, it's just not that significant. Markets are shrugging it off. Now, it will hit some places pretty hard. You look at a state like Virginia that is very dependent on defense spending and military spending. It'll hit that state, and it'll hit, you know, certain companies to a certain extent because they're reliant on government defense spending. But for the most part, the expectation is that the economy can make it through this without a huge hit.
You agree, Greg Zuckerman? Markets sort of shrugging off the sequester?
I would actually argue that the markets maybe are cheering what's going on in Washington. The market's been very frustrated with how politicians haven't agreed. Everyone sort of understands we have to raise taxes and we have to cut spending. We have to do both. But they haven't come to any kind of agreement. Well, it's being forced upon them. And at the end of the day, the pain really isn't that great, as Trish mentioned. I mean, as a percentage of a $3.8 trillion fiscal 2013 budget, this is pretty small stuff. But maybe it's a sign that we finally can cut some of our debt.
And Matt Phillips, I'll give you the last word on this before our break. Markets cheering the sequester?
I don't know about that. I mean, the one thing I'd add is that when you're in a fragile economy, I mean, things have been getting better, but we're not anywhere where we were before the crisis. We really don't know. It becomes less clear how cutting spending and raising taxes affects the economy. That's something called the fiscal multiplier, and there's a big debate about it right now. So I kind of worry about the sequester.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we've got three great economics reporters with us today to talk about the different numbers coming out of the economy and the stock market and to help us make sense of it all. My guests are Trish Regan, host of Bloomberg's daily business program Street Smart, Greg Zuckerman of The Wall Street Journal, and Matt Phillips of the business journal Quartz. Let's go to the phones. A lot of callers waiting to join us here. Andrew is first. He's in Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I have a general question. We seem to be all concerned about how the Dow Jones Industrial Average has suddenly shot up and how it just reached new high. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average is subject to not only forces in the economy, but also a subjective choice of what goes on the Dow Jones list. It's a weighted average of 30 different companies, some that have been added as recent as 2012 and one that's been on there since 1928. Mm. So, aren't we, you know, don't we have to factor that in that, you know, we're seeing the companies that are perhaps the best, but there are other averages. There's the S&P 500, which is 500 companies, and then there's the Russell 1000. And if this is going to be such a point of contention for the government, shouldn't the government, perhaps from the Congressional Budget Office or a bipartisan committee, be picking the stocks that would most represent how the economy is doing? Because all the companies on the Dow Jones are massive. And isn't the performance of the economy really also subject to the smaller, medium, and small businesses?
Andrew, it's an excellent question. You must have been reading the Financial Times today because John Authors actually says the same thing, essentially agreeing that the Dow is an outdated, flawed indicator of the market, that it's not broadly diversified, that it reflects metrics that don't really capture an accurate picture of the economy anymore. Greg Zuckerman, do you agree with that?
I don't know. I think it's a poor argument. I mean, first off, the S&P 500 is very close to its own all-time highs. So if you want to use that index, you know, we'd still be talking about the market's rebound. And also the S&P 500 and Dow Jones have tracked each other for decades. So it's pretty good barometer, the Dow. And do we really want the government to get involved picking stocks for our stock indices? I would argue that they've got their hands full with other things.
Trish Regan, what do you think?
Yeah, and also, I completely agree. I think it would be a dangerous, slippery slope to have the government start picking the stocks that are in the indices, such as the Dow or the S&P. Again, S&P is looking like it's about to hit an all-time high. And I'd also point you to the Russell 2000, which makes up all the small-cap companies, and that's also doing enormously well. So we're looking at a market overall of stock prices across the board that really are showing a lot of upside right now.
Matt Phillips, what do you think? Is the Dow a sort of outdated, flawed indicator of the market as it stands?
Well, there's no perfect indicator. There's no way to capture, everything in the market. But Trish brings up a good point when you talk about the Russell, because those are small capitalization stocks, and they're usually thought to reflect more U.S. domestic sales because They're not big global blue chip companies like you have it in the Dow and the S&P. And the Russell 2000 has been running way ahead of the bigger indexes, which is another reason I think that the U.S. domestic economy is in, you know, fairly decent shape.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Here's Carl on the line. Welcome to the program, Carl. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for welcoming to the program. First of all, what a horrible socialist Obama has turned out to be. Just horrible. And second, the fake argument that I've been hearing over the past 3 or 4 years here, and it's even been echoed by the media, is that businesses and corporations are afraid of hiring people because the uncertainty. And that's just so false, so fake, because, you know, the uncertainty is this. Well, the certainty is this. Big corporations have realized that they can get away with less people and make more money. That's what that's all about. Mm-hmm. And as far as small businesses, hey, I'm a small business owner, and I've been doing great since 2009. So I don't know what that guy was talking about. Thank you.
Carl, thank you very much. Is this a new reality? Corporations, they've learned to, you know, make do with less. Greg Zuckerman.
Yeah, I completely agree, actually. I think there's been a structural change in the economy, and many businesses over the past few years realized or worked to get to the point where they could operate pretty efficiently with fewer workers. You can argue we don't like that, we do like that. It's not for me to say, but, you know, we're in a capitalist system, and they have adjusted. As a result, we may not get unemployment much lower than 6% or maybe even 7%, unfortunately. But what's important to remember is that the stock market isn't necessarily a reflection of the overall economy. It's a reflection of the companies and their profits. And profits are pretty strong. And I concur with the last caller. Markets have done really well under Democrats. You go back to the Clinton period as well. There's a lot of irony there. And uncertainty is a silly argument. There's always uncertainty. So people blaming uncertainty. It's nothing to do with Obama and uncertainty. The economy is looking much better.
Trish Regan, why aren't companies doing more hiring?
Well, because they've realized that they can do more with less. They've become incredibly profitable with fewer workers. But I would also say that there is some strength to this argument that companies don't want to invest right now, whether that be in capital spending in terms of building new factories or whether it be in new workers, because they're still not certain what the future holds. I think that's beginning to change, but I can tell you, as we were going into the end of last year, it was fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff. And CEO after CEO would tell me, you know, I'm just not convinced I can hire right now because I'm not certain what the future holds. Of course, the danger there, Jane, is that they're late to the game, right? All of a sudden, demand picks up significantly. If we see this economy just take off, they won't be prepared to handle the increased demand. But right now, they're not seeing enough end user demand to justify a big capital increase, whether that be on new factories or new employees.
Mm. Matt Phillips, is that how you see it?
I do tend to agree with Trish on that last point. I think that when it comes to certainty, this kind of amorphous concept of certainty or demand, business owners tend to be pretty practical. If they see people lining up at the door, that's when they're going to invest. And regardless of their political leanings, that's why they're in existence, to serve customers. So I think that's the main point. I mean, the other thing I just mentioned is that we do have these really interesting structural changes in the labor market. You've got automation, outsourcing, offshoring. It just seems that the growth in the job sectors we've seen have been really low wage, and that's sort of skewing American wages lower. And I think that's part of why you saw Obama come out in his State of the Union and advocate for a higher minimum wage, because it's kind of a tacit acknowledgement that that's sort of what our economy kind of looks like now.
Your comment, Lee?
This is Greg.
Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
I'm sorry, this is Greg. If I could just weigh in for a second. I've been covering the markets for, over a decade here. I've never been in a point where people say I've got certainty. This whole silliness about, oh, there's uncertainty, so I'm not hiring. It's a fig leaf. They have changed their businesses and they want an excuse for not hiring. It just happens to be that they don't need as many workers. I don't think that there's more certainty. When is there ever certainty about the economy?
When people were looking in 2005, 2006, they were pretty certain. And
wrong.
Yeah, and wrong. So I think if I see people who are saying, I am completely certain something is going to happen, I would run away from that company.
But see, that's the danger here, and that's what I was talking about, that if they don't actually move now to hire, they may be caught in a situation where they can't actually meet end-user demand. So it's this balance that they need to somehow strike to say, okay, I can look far enough ahead to assume that the economy is improving enough, I'm going to make these new hire investments. And if they don't do it, they could be caught in a bind.
Hiring's one thing, but this leads me to a New York Times story here that says corporate profits are way up, wages have stagnated, they are flat. Is that an accurate portrayal? Is that our future, Greg Zuckerman?
It might be, unfortunately, yeah. You know, there are an interesting number of investors on Wall Street who have bought gold over the past few years, and the argument being that the Fed has been so active, interest rates are so low, eventually you're going to get wage gains and eventually you're going to get inflation. And even the experts on Wall Street have been shocked by how little, what small piece of the pie consumers and workers are getting.
Matt Phillips?
Yeah, I would agree with that. To Greg's point, I mean, it's interesting to see this year, I think gold is probably one of the worst performing assets around. I mean, people seem to be kind of abandoning that view. And if you take Greg's point that that's sort of an acceptance of a sort of low wage America, that's kind of troublesome, I guess.
Trish Regan?
Yeah, this is the central problem. We need to create jobs. If we do not create jobs, I don't think you can justify having a market as high as it is right now. I mean, you look back to the previous high, the fundamentals when it came to the number of Americans that were unemployed were significantly less than what they are now. The fundamentals looked better. We need to get people back to work in order to create demand, in order to keep corporate profits chugging along.
Here's Patrick in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Patrick. Welcome.
Yeah, how you doing, Jane?
Hi, well, go ahead.
I just wanted to comment, 60% of the people in the United States aren't invested in the stock market. That's most of the people in the country don't even have any stocks or any mutual funds or anything. It's because, and it really hurts, because we're out here with no pensions. They're talking about cutting Social Security to straighten out the deficit. And we see all this money being siphoned upward in the economy towards the upper 1% or upper 10% of the citizens of this country. You know, it's not going to help anybody if the stock market's going up. It's only going to help a small percentage of the population. And we've been seeing this happening for decades now, where this canyon between the super rich and the middle class has been widening and widening, and there's no end in sight. We know why there's no jobs. We know that the jobs are being exported to countries where the wages are $1 an hour, if at best. And also, automation is knocking people out of the workforce. You know, technology is knocking people out of the workforce. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to turn around. The problem is that whenever the government or whenever anybody wants to raise taxes on the people, the investor class, I'll call them, they scream bloody murder. You talk about 1% or 2%. You know, this company was chugging along great when the upper marginal limit of the income tax was 75%. Now it's at 34%, 35%, I think.
Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Greg Zuckerman, would you respond?
Well, I've been traveling the country a little bit, doing this research on my energy book. And frankly, when you get away from the coasts, you see you get to see a different view. You see people out of school with little education, sometimes making over $100,000 in Louisiana and Texas and North Dakota, where unemployment is under 1%. We've got a structural issue where we have people that are on the coasts often who are unemployed, and sometimes it's housing that holds them back from moving to some of these areas, other reasons as well. But there is this kind of strength. And, yeah, there are too many people that aren't participating in the stock market. I agree. But there are enough people out there who are actually getting new, well-paid jobs in these kind of up-and-coming industries. And you talk about manufacturing. Well, there's a whole resurgence going on and renaissance where chemical companies and steel companies, they are building new plants, Pennsylvania and other kinds of places.
Trish Regan, you know, Patrick brings up an interesting point when he mentions jobs going overseas to cheaper labor. And so I'm curious, as U.S. companies rely more on that overseas, have their fortunes become more disconnected from the state of the U.S. economy?
Well, the little bit of good news here, Jane, is that we're starting to see more U.S. manufacturers start to onshore, because the cost of labor in China is going up. enough for them to start saying, okay, maybe it's better if we bring these jobs back home. So we're seeing a little bit of a shift there. As China becomes more expensive for them to do business in, they're considering bringing some of these jobs back home. So we may start to see a little bit of a shift there. But, you know, I think Patrick really hit on something. And the danger here is that we're moving more and more towards an hourglass economy, where you have a lot of people at the bottom, you have people at the top, and this middle class is getting really squeezed. Part of that is because what Greg was talking about earlier, we've seen this real structural change in employment. You know, the economy has changed. Our nation has changed. The jobs that, you know, our parents once had or our grandparents once had, those don't exist anymore. So when you look out at the future, the question is, how are we going to stay competitive as a nation? I mean, I've got three kids. Jane, I know you've got kids. And you think, it's education, it's being on top of technology, it's staying competitive. And right now, we don't have a lot of the programs and infrastructure in place to make sure that this next generation of Americans can succeed.
Matt Phillips, that issue of competitiveness comes up over and over, doesn't it?
It does. One thing I'd like to just point out about what Patrick said, and I sympathize with a lot of his positions, but his facts were wrong. About 50% of American families have stocks, either directly, like they own shares of Exxon, or, you know, indirectly through a 401k or a pension or something. So American families do benefit. It does. He's right, though. It does skew towards the wealthier and the older. But the fact is, the stock market is really important for the confidence of American consumers, and that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve has been quite open about what they're hoping to do by driving markets higher. They want that what they call a wealth effect, where asset prices like stocks go up, people feel a little bit better and are more willing to spend. One point I just make is that the Bank of when Japan had a very similar crisis to us back in the early 90s, and their central bank acted very differently. Their stock market remains about 70% lower than it was in January 1990. Now, do you remember when stocks were at their worst in America, they were about 50% down? And think about how horrible everybody felt looking at their 401k. I mean, that crushes consumer confidence. So, you know, you can object to what the Fed has done, but I think it's been really important for the psyche of American consumers.
Greg Zuckerman, before we go to break here, over and over again, economists tell us that the market and the economy are not the same thing. I mean, what is the Dow not telling us about what's happening and what will happen moving forward?
I think not telling us about some of these problems that we've addressed today, and the fact that the middle class, but especially the underclass, is having a real tough time of it. Although I do want to point out, in terms of competitiveness, we are more competitive than ever as a country. I would bet on the United States over almost any country going forward. China, all kinds of other places. We're open to immigrants. We've got all these natural gas prices coming down because we're moving towards energy independence. Our labor costs are looking a little better relative as Trish mentioned. China and other countries, the labor costs are rising. So I'm actually pretty bullish on the country.
Trish Regan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I say don't bet against America. I mean, we're a nimble economy. We have such a tremendous work ethic. There are so many things that make us terrific as a nation, but we need to keep our edge. And part of keeping our edge is staying competitive and making sure that we're doing all that we can to educate our young and to make sure that we really hold our place in the world.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're trying to read the economic tea leaves this hour to take stock of where we are economically as we continue our slow crawl out of bad times. My guests are Trish Regan, host of Bloomberg's Daily Business Program, Street Smart, Greg Zuckerman of The Wall Street Journal, and Matt Phillips of the Business Journal Quartz. Matt Phillips, we just saw here that you tweeted out, never, ever question the power of fracking. That's what I learned from the Beige Book. So we're watching your tweets, my friend. You're talking about energy's boom and the impact on the economy. I guess the question out of that is what are the bright lights in this economy? Is this a new energy boom? Is technology something to watch? Where are we growing, do you think?
Well, yeah, reading the Beige Book, which is can be mind-numbing sometimes, but you can kind of glean some really interesting little insights here and there. I mean, the details that come through about how the fracking boom is affecting the economy are really interesting. There's little anecdotes like in the Philly Feds district, which includes Pennsylvania, where the Marcellus Shale field is. They are, talk about bankers saying how they have people coming in paying off debt with cash that they got from their royalties. And in the Cleveland Fed, which has some of Western Pennsylvania in their jurisdiction, they talk about how auto dealers there are worried that they're going to lose technicians to the gas boom, that their mechanics are basically going to be lured away to work in higher priced jobs in the oil fields or gas fields. So it's pretty remarkable. And I think I think Mr. Zuckerman picked a good topic to write a book on because I think a lot of people are going to be want to be talking about it over the next few years.
Take the floor, Greg. What do you say?
Well, the one thing that I found interesting when I was traveling the country a little bit is there's something of a resurgence in rural America. So for years, people would be moving out of these smaller towns and unhappy to live there. And you really see kind of both people moving back, moving because often they're closer to an oil or a gas well or a city that's doing some work. Gone to Louisiana, some of these places, and Texas, obviously, North Dakota, where unemployment's as low as one can imagine. So I am encouraged by the fact that cities are doing much better in a country, but so is rural America.
Trish Regan, what do you see as the bright lights in this new economy?
Well, it's energy. It really comes back to this energy boom. The idea that we can be energy independent by 2020, it's phenomenal. I mean, a few years ago, this just wasn't really on the radar. So it's exciting, and it could be a huge industry for us. And I think it's for so many reasons, not just for what it means for our economy, but also from a national security standpoint. There are so many reasons to champion the energy sector right now.
Back to the phone. Savannah, Georgia is where Neil is waiting. Hello, Neil. Welcome to One Point.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I guess I just wanted to echo the point that it seems that most of our economic indicators seem to only tell us how well the rich are doing. And even something that could be construed as positive, like, you know, rising home prices, can be deceiving if they're only rising because institutional investors are snatching up all the homes that, you know, middle-class Americans were put out of.
Neil, thank you. I appreciate your perspective. Greg Zuckerman, do you want to respond?
The average home is up. So that's the average home. It's not just the home of the wealthy. So, you know, some of these indices do track broader kinds of things. And, you know, corporate America is just playing the profits of corporations across the country. You know, corporations hire you and me. So, yeah, there are obviously pockets of weakness and structural issues, as I discussed. And it's so stubborn, this unemployment rate, and we can't get it as low as it should be. But you can't lose track of the fact that relative to every other country around the world, I mean, we're doing much better.
We keep hearing, Trish Regan, that the old jobs, the already lost jobs, they're not coming back. We've talked a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. How does this economy make productive use of the underemployed, other than just being consumers?
Well, I think that's the real challenge right now. You know, they can't be consumers if they're not employed. So they need to be employed. Unfortunately, you know, the new reality is a lot of people are thankful to have a job at Walmart right now, where they're, you know, barely getting by. So it's an issue because for us to grow as a nation, for GDP to grow, we need to have people consuming all these products that these companies are trying to make. You know, and I don't really know the real answer in the near term. I think that there are some obviously, you know, some things that we can do as you look ahead. But they involve a lot of education and transitioning our workforce from, you know, one that maybe was a manufacturing workforce to more of a services sector and high-end services, whether that's, you know, things like, you know, creating financial products, whether it's technology products. And when it comes to manufacturing, really having some kind of an edge. So you're not just someone who's pressing a button in a factory, but rather adding some kind of intellectual capital to the process.
Matt Phillips, how do you see it? How does this economy make use of our underemployed?
Well, we are creating some jobs. I think last year we averaged about 180 or 181,000 jobs a month after the revisions were put in recently. So it's not terrible. One thing I think we have to keep in mind is that obviously people need to work, but the key to American consumption hasn't been wage growth for like decades. Like Americans don't spend more because they're making more. They spend more because they can borrow more. And the problem, that's not a great system, but that's our system. And if credit markets are open and it's cheap, people will spend, and that fuels our economy. And since our economy is about 70% consumption, I mean, that's what we're seeing in the automotive industry.
But
I mean, it's not a great... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't what we learned in the last crash that excessive, you know, debt was the great American sin? You know, we ran up so much credit card debt, too big mortgages, too many car loans, that we're supposed to save more. And so you're saying, I guess, here that Americans need to be bigger spenders, bigger debtors again, if we want this economy to pick up?
I agree. That is what we learned. But we didn't change it. We didn't change anything structurally about it. I mean, I'm not arguing that this is a great system, but it's our system. And if we worry that if we focus too much on wage growth, we might miss something because really what's fueled consumption is credit. It's not wages.
If I could interject,
yeah,
though, I mean, it has not always been our system. This was the system as of late. I mean, you look back since the year 1999, 2000, and, you know, some of the blame perhaps could be going to the Fed because we saw a huge run-up in tech stocks as we went into 2000. That bubble burst. And then what did everybody do? They took their money out of the market, put it into their home, and there was this huge real estate bubble that eventually came back to haunt us. And so now you're saying, well, what is the next? I mean, there are always unintended consequences with everything. And so the question now is, are we running into some kind of asset bubble as a result of all this money printing? That's one of the big questions out there. And as far as, you know, the U.S. consumer taking on more and more debt, we learned that that did not end well last time around. Now the consumer has less debt. They've improved their balance sheets. We now have a government that has taken on, you know, huge amounts, record amounts of debt, and there's really no end in sight or plan to get out of it. And I just don't know how this ends well, or do we just keep going through some kind of cycle where prices get bid up, and then there's a bubble that bursts, and then you have to keep starting over again?
Greg Zuckerman.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jane, that I find this conversation about how we're worried about consumer spending in this country kind of ironic. I'm not worried about the American consumer. He or she seems to be okay at being able to spend for good or for bad. I'm more worried about their balance sheet and whether they've been improving it or not. And frankly, they are slowly. So I'm not worried about that, whether we'll be able to do enough spending down the road. I'm worried about their ability to pay off debt. And slowly but surely we are. You're seeing it much higher with some things like student loans, which people are investing in education, which I guess is good to see. But elsewhere, things are coming down, credit cards and other kinds of debt, which is really a helpful sign.
Back to the phones, Bridgeport, Connecticut. John, hi. Welcome to the program, John. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Jane. I guess I live in a city that has suffered some restructuring over our history. We used to be a manufacturing center. We're not no longer one. Haven't been one for generations. People have been displaced and hurting and suffering from a variety of things like crime and unemployment for years. I think the panel is rather glib when they talk about looking forward to an hourglass-shaped economy, expect low wages, and accept the fact that corporations can get by with fewer employees. I don't know how they expect this economy to work if the American people, used to be called the American people, now called the consumer, do not have the ability to consume. I just wonder what they have to say about that. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I'm glad you called, John. Thank you. Trish Regan.
Yeah, I agree with him. I don't think it works. I think that we're going to face some serious challenges ahead unless we have a vibrant middle class an American population then could be out there and consume. Don't forget, consumer spending is roughly 70% of this economy. So you need a vibrant consumer in order to grow. Without that, you don't have a whole lot.
Greg Zuckerman.
I'm not as worried. I think for every city that's struggling and having manufacturing losing manufacturing jobs, you're seeing at least one elsewhere that's having a resurgence and hiring is on the rise and their new industries, be it energy or elsewhere. So it's not to say that I don't feel for people that are having a tough time of it. I clearly do. But I'm also aware of others that are doing much better, thankfully.
Matt Phillips, jump in, respond to John.
Well, I'm from upstate New York, so we understand manufacturing decline. So I think it's true, and I think that a lot of communities are really in a tough space. You know, and one of the things I worry about is so many of, like, talking about upstate New York, so many of the communities there seem to have focused on health care and education as the way out. You can see this sort of across the Northeast. And to me, that's just another form of, you know, another form of debt, you know, that they're hoping to capitalize on. You know, one is government debt in the form of healthcare spending. And, you know, it's not really a growth industry, sort of becoming a hospital center where you are nursing an aging population. That doesn't make me really excited about the growth prospects. I totally sympathize, and I think he has a point. We shouldn't be glib about people who are really caught in these tough economic situations. And I think you can see in the minimum wage proposal from the president that they're kind of really starting to get concerned about this, and they don't really see a way out of it anytime soon, and so they're hoping to sort of mandate a wage increase.
What about overseas activity? Could Europe affect us one way or another moving forward, Trish?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we export a lot of our goods to Europe, so any downturn in their economy affects us directly. That said, and let's also not forget that if they suffer a severe banking crisis as a result of everything that's going on, that then trickles back over here. But there are some positive signs when it comes to Europe right now. For the most part, it looks like they're going to muddle through. It looks like they've been able to contain this crisis. And while Italy is certainly a political wild card right now, things are looking fairly stable, not good, but at least stable, as though they're not going to implode in Europe. And that's good news for us.
And Greg Zuckerman, what about China, who announced it would maintain a growth target, I think about 7.5% this year, pledged to plow more money into its economy? I mean, it's kind of the tail on the dog here, would you say?
You know, it's interesting. That's been the area I've been most worried about, the global economy, the housing bubble there, what can argue is a bubble. And frankly, I've been wrong. So they've proved resilient, be it artificially or not. It's hard to believe the numbers sometimes coming out of China. But they've been stronger than I would have expected and maybe some other people would have expected. Now they're worried about keeping the economy a little slower so as not to inflate. So that's, you know, as Trish mentioned, you get some stabilization in Europe. You get China keeping its growth apace. That can only be good.
Matt Phillips, how do you see the picture overseas?
I'd echo something that Greg said. I mean, over the last year or so, you had seen investors, both retail and institutional, pouring cash into emerging market bonds, where they saw higher yields and better potential for growth, especially into emerging market corporate debt, where I would argue that their understanding maybe of the legal frameworks in some of those countries is less than perfect. So if I was going to worry about something going wrong, I kind of would worry about there, because that's where the if there was a sense of euphoria, that's where it's been.
A couple quick questions before we end here. Will this hot stock market cause the Fed to rethink raising interest rates? Trish Regan, what do you think?
No. No, I think that the Fed is encouraged by, the Fed doesn't do anything specifically just to raise asset prices in the stock market, but this is certainly an added bonus and something that they are glad to see, with the hope that it's overall going to encourage Americans right now and really sort of raise the level of confidence among people. So I think they see this as a good sign. And, you know, as Greg mentioned earlier, on a PE valuation basis, the stocks are still relatively cheap. So there's some room for this to go. It won't come back to haunt them unless, in fact, we just don't see any economic fundamental improvement.
So in our last couple of minutes here, let's do a whip around of our panel and tell us where you think this market is going. It is hot now. Will it be so coming up? Greg Zuckerman, you first.
I think we go higher until the bond market cracks. That's where I'm most worried about. Junk bonds and other types of bonds are very risky right now. In 2007, we hit a top in the stock market, but we had already had peaked in the bond market. We were having deep problems in a lot of parts of the risky bond market. That's where I would caution people and have people kind of keep an eye on. When you see problems in the bond market, then stocks have problems. But for now, things are good.
Matt Phillips.
I would agree. Watch the Fed. I mean, when we have had sort of soft patches in this run-up since March 2009, it's been because there's been some indication that the Fed might be stopping a program or tapering something off, and that's where we've seen things kind of soften quite a bit. So just really pay attention to, you know, read those Fed speeches and keep your eyes peeled.
All right, Trish Regan, finish us off here.
Yeah, no, again, I don't think the Fed's going to move until it really sees a lower unemployment rate. So I think the Fed's going to basically keep the money printing, if you would, going for a while. I'd also watch for this great rotation that people talk about, getting out of fixed income, getting out of bonds, going into equities. There's a lot more money that can pour into the equity market. That's going to help fuel the stock market in the future as well.
Great information this hour. I really appreciate your time, all of you. Trish Regan joining us from New York, anchor on Bloomberg Television, host of Bloomberg's daily business program, Street Smart. Trish, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Matt Phillips, also in New York, covers finance, markets, and economics for the new online business journal, Quartz. Matt, thanks to you.
Jane, thank you so much.
And Greg Zuckerman, as always, we appreciate your time. Greg, senior writer at the Wall Street Journal and author of the widely read Heard on the Street column. Greg, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. The News in the Week roundtable is coming up tomorrow. We'll see you then. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.